Welcome to Always Searching, the podcast challenging conventional wisdom about health and wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Lynn Mark. I'm delighted that you're here. My guest today is both a producer and an executive producer of 25 motion pictures, including Arlington Road and Revenge of the Nerds. He calls himself a pro-social entrepreneur, founding the Starlight Foundation, First Star, and Everyone Deserves a Roof. Welcome to the show, Always Searching, my dear friend, Peter Samuelson.
Sarah Lynn, I'm so happy to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. I believe you just got back from England, so there might be a bit of jet lag, but hopefully this program will waken us and keep us on our toes. Peter, you were born in England. I believe you went to Cambridge. Can you tell us a little bit about your life in England and how you got into what you were doing? What were some of the first steps and why you chose even Cambridge?
Well, Cambridge chose me, actually. The pivot for me was that in 10th grade, I had an English teacher called Mr. Lund. I'm sure he had a first name, but we were never privileged to know it. He said to me, see me after school, and I did. Never seems like a good idea to see a teacher after school. But what he actually did was to poke me in the chest with his finger and say, you know, if you work twice as hard, you could go to a really good university. And I said, I sort of laughed. And I said, I'm certain that that is not the case. And he said, why did you say that? And I said, well, my dad left school at 14. As far as I know, there is not a single person anywhere in my family, cousins and whatever, that has ever been to university. And he said, oh, well, then it'll be even better, won't it? Because you'll be the first one. So in that moment, I realize, looking back on it, that that's what pivoted my life. And I got myself a scholarship to Cambridge. I got my bachelor's. I got my master's. And then I realized that what no one had told me was that knowing a great deal about medieval English literature did not really ideally suit you for getting a high-paying job or, frankly, any job. And I had earned pocket money while I was at university by working as an interpreter. And I'd met an American producer who made television commercials. And I worked for him in North Africa, in Morocco. And he said to me, do you want to come back to the States and see how we edit? And I said, oh, that would be fantastic. And so I found myself at the age of, 22 or whatever I was, in Los Angeles on my own with a job. And, several years later, you wake up and you say, oh, I suppose I live here, do I? you realize I have a wife, I have a child, I have a house, I have a mortgage. I have, a rolling, doing rather well career. This must be where I belong. And so a lot of what I've done since has been realizing that I've had the benefit of the American dream. What's written on the base of the Statue of Liberty, give us your huddled masses. So I was a huddled mass. And America has been, to quote the opening line of The Godfather, America has been good to me. And a lot of what I've done philanthropically has been directly in an attempt to do right by the country that gave me my career and my life.
You know, what you bring up, Peter, is so important. First of all, you're talking about having a mentor early on in life, being open to what they're saying, and then also being open to opportunities. But it's not so easy. What were some of the challenges that you faced when, for example, when you went over to Morocco or when you decided to come to the United States? And how did you navigate that? Who did you turn to? What was it that helped you to get through it?
Well, I think you find a resourcefulness in yourself. I didn't start out as a film producer. I worked my way up to film producer. I didn't actually get a producing credit till 1980. On a Paul Mazursky, Donald Sutherland film called A Man, A Woman, and a Bank, which we made in Vancouver, the second film ever made in the city of Vancouver. They've made a few there since. I think what you realize as a producer, you develop pattern recognition, because every time you entrepreneur a new film and just sort of shove it into happening every which way, you draw increasingly on pattern recognition, because although all the people are different and all the challenges are different, they fit into patterns that you have trained by addressing, and you realize you're doing, on a new film, you're doing the same thing again. And film producing is the most entrepreneurial thing you can possibly imagine, because every year or so, it's a whole new set of challenges, and you just sort of ram your way through it. And by the time you've made 24 films, you've become, immodestly, you've become rather good at it and resilient. And what I did was to take that toolkit of being an entrepreneur in media, mm-hmm. and by complete happenstance, I took it over into the world of charity, nonprofit, philanthropy. And I realized I can start charities. I can research a challenge in society that is very poorly addressed. I can dream up a potential new solution. I can make it start. I can pilot it. I can measure it. I can get a proof of concept, and then I can replicate it. And that's what I've done in the NGO world, the nonprofit world, now, you know, thank God, extensively, and rather for those causes, rather successfully. But it's the same toolkit that I'm carrying with me in my head as making films.
So it's really incredible. So you're really translating, as you say, your skill kit, your experiences. Let's go back to the movies for just a moment, because I see sort of a common theme. There's that social impact theme in several of your movies. How did you choose which films you wanted to produce? Was there something about each one of them that just drew you to it? And how would you know that they were going to be a success?
Well, I think what I have realized is that what we are as filmmakers is storytellers.
Right.
And whether it was the guy in, you know, medieval times before the printing press who came to a village and stood on a rock in the market square and said, "Gather ye around and I shall tell you a story," or whether it's a filmmaker using, you know, audiovisual technology, your goal is to move the heart of your audience, make them laugh, make them mm-hmm. cry, scare them, make them feel empathy. And what I realize is a common thread is that films that work and that are commercially successful do so through word of mouth. And the word of mouth is primarily based on the fact that we are following the hero's progress, or heroine's progress increasingly, thank God these days. And as we follow their checkered and challenged moments, we are experiencing the thrill of empathy. We are identifying with the heroic character and all their flaws. And when they have a victory, it is our victory as well. Somewhere in there, I started having a parallel life, because I founded the first of my nonprofits, the Starlight Children's Foundation. And I started realizing that we could have a remarkable effect, in that case, on the happiness of seriously ill children. And so the more I was doing that with separate people and separate rooms, but in parallel to my storytelling film career, the more I started to realize, I think we could make films of substance. Mm-hmm. I think we could move people's hearts. And my theory is that people's hearts are only moved for about 20 minutes, or if you're lucky, 30 minutes. They come out of the theater and get in the car and go home and do the washing up and walk the dog. They've forgotten all about your film.
Right.
Their heart is no longer moved. But if you get at them through the QR code, through the website, through standing up at the front of the theater, and if you ask them to do something which will ameliorate the issue which has moved their heart, if that is what the film is about, you can get them to sign the organ donor registry. You can get them to donate to the World Wildlife Fund. You can have them contribute to research into different types of cancer. You can use the empathy that comes from narrative filmmaking or documentary filmmaking, but it's easier, frankly, with narrative because then there's such a strong identification with the character. You can, if you have partnered with 501c3s who really understand their issue, whether it's the American Cancer Society or the World Wildlife Fund, whoever it is, if you make your film serve their goals as well as being commercial, and in this context, all that commercial means is lots and lots and lots of people will want to watch the film or the television show, whatever it is. If you can make a film of substance about something, you will not only move the hearts of your audience, but you can actually move the needle in the real world in ameliorating the issue, which is the subject of your film.
Such an important point, Peter. And I'm sitting here thinking about how the pandemic really influenced that. You know, I've seen you in person. In fact, I remember meeting you for the first time. I believe it was 2014 at the United Nations. We were giving talks for a global health conference. And you captured the room. You had them in your hands as you walked among everyone while they were eating lunch, talking about some of your important work that you were doing. So during the pandemic, we've been living more in this virtual world. And films are being streamed and people weren't going into the theater and people didn't have that opportunity to have that in-person experience. Did you find that it impacted what you were able to convey, or did you change technology so you could reach your audiences more effectively?
Well, I suppose I have a head start because mm-hmm. I'm used to not being in the room. I don't work in theater. I work in film and television.
Right.
So I'm not physically present sitting in the next row staring into the eyes of my audience. I'm doing it remotely. I'm guessing and using my intuition and my experience as to what will move their heart. And I think when you've done it enough, you develop skills in moving people's hearts, and you can take them over to, you know, Zoom and WhatsApp and Google Meets and all mm-hmm. the rest of it. Mm-hmm. It's not as good. I wouldn't pretend that it's as good as face-to-face, you know, especially when you've got 400 people on the Zoom.
Yeah.
You know, how could you possibly read how they're viewing what you're telling them? You know, there isn't a feedback loop. But here we are right now, Sarah Lynn, you and I.
Right.
You've only got my voice there, and I've only got yours, and yet I have a sense of you, and hopefully you have a sense of me, and we use what's available, and mm-hmm. Absolutely it's not as good. On the other hand, there are in an ocean of disadvantages from the COVID, I mean, just about wall-to-wall awfulness.
Right.
One thing that does arise from it is that I think the level of latent empathy in people is increased. All four of my 501c3 nonprofits have raised more money during the COVID than in the prior 2 years.
Wow, it's remarkable.
You might well say, well, how is that even possible?
Right.
And the answer is because I think we're all hanging on in some way or other mm-hmm. to the, you know, the tabletop with our fingertips. And I think it gives us, when you feel that your own life is a bit more fragile than perhaps it was, I think you have empathy for those similarly situated.
And you certainly have channeled that across the board. Let's talk for just a minute about the Starlight Children's Foundation that you created with Steven Spielberg. How did that come about? How did you connect to Steven Spielberg to do this? And I love the fact that you say you deliver happiness, and we all can use happiness. Can you share with us some of your insights about
sure.
all of this?
My cousin, at that time, a fledgling actress in London, went in connection with the premiere of a film to Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital in costume and met a little boy, Sean, who was 11, mm-hmm. And I remember vividly her phoning me and saying, I've really done it now. I've promised this dying child that he can come to America. Because I asked him, what would make you happy, Sean? And he said, oh, I want to see Disneyland. And I said, well, if you've told him he's coming, we've got to work out how to do it. So we flew him and his mom over, and everyone moved into my apartment, including the cousin and Sean and the mom. And for 2 weeks, we did everything you shouldn't do with a dying, terminally ill child. And he had a wonderful time. His mom had a wonderful time, and we had a wonderful time. And when he went home and passed away, we realized that we had left Brenda, the mom, with something incredibly valuable, which was a happy set of memories of her departed son, instead of just his last moments with a tube up his nose in a hospital bed.
Right.
So I called a meeting after work. I was running a company back then called Interscope. And I just called a meeting in our conference room. And I said, look, I don't know anything about medicine, but I have to believe there are a lot of other kids who are seriously ill, and they're probably sad, and their parents and their siblings are probably sad as well. Why don't we ask them what would make them happy, and then let's do it. A few times a year, we'll do it. So that was 1984. That was the beginning of the Starlight Children's Foundation. Here we are. It's 2022. And in that period of time, through our offices across the United States, in Canada, Australia, and the UK, we've raised and spent over $1 billion philanthropically to make seriously ill kids and mums and dads and siblings happier. And we have helped about 60 million families to date. So that's the Starlight Children's Foundation. I was introduced to Stephen, and I pitched up there at Amblin, and I'd never met him before. And, you know, his office does everything to scare the heck out of you. You'll have 30 minutes with Mr. Spielberg. Don't give him the collateral material. You leave that with me. And he's got the ambassador from someone coming in on the hour, so you'll have to be gone by then, and on and on. And I go in, and it's sort of like, it's like a cartoon, because I'm looking at this man who's being very nice to me, very embracing, very interested and whip smart. And I'm thinking he looks exactly like Steven Spielberg. You know? Oh, I guess that's because he's Steven Spielberg. And I'm looking at my watch and I'm thinking, oh, well, we're well past the hour. Oh, I've been here 90 minutes. Oh, I've been here over 2 hours. And at the end of it, he said, what do you want me to do? And I said, be the chairman. And we will, with this newfangled internet thing, this was 1991 when Stephen came in. I said, I think one of the principal challenges of immunosuppressed kids is that they are in a bubble and they can't be hugged, let alone play with friends. What if we were to use this newfangled internet to link together immunosuppressed kids through the internet from one hospital to another, from room to room, and with their schools and with their mums and dads and siblings at home and all the rest of it. And we actually did it. You know, Stephen is a prodigious force in business and in media and creatively. The next thing I know, we've raised, you know, Paul Allen gave us $6 million. Wow. We've raised Helping Kind from Intel and Sprint and Knowledge Adventures. And we built this amazing thing long before Facebook, long before MySpace, long before any of the online social networks. We had Starbright World, and we were, honest to goodness, linking kids together. And an amazing thing happened. We had thought we're doing it for no more complicated reason than to make them happy. And then we started getting anecdotal reports from child life and medical staff. And then we invested in quite a lot of research. And this was at the very beginning of the field of psychoneuroimmunology, which posits that, and we were actually doing it, if you raise the spirits, the mental health of a person with a suppressed immune system, if their T cell count is low, if you make them happy, you can raise their T cell count. Furthermore, if their T cell count is suppressed, it makes them sad. And it's a circular relationship. When we started doing it, we used to say to each other, don't tell anybody. For God's sake, they'll think we're Shirley MacLaine laying on crystals or hands or something. Right. Or other. But of course, it all became when psychoneuroimmunology had really been studied, some of it studying our systems. And it went beyond just, T cell count. It also went into the perception of pain. Pain is obviously by definition subjective, right. But if you distract someone's attention, they don't use as much self-dosed morphine. And we rigged up those clicker buttons that the kids had, where if the pain became intolerable, they'd click it and it would give them a micro dose in the IV of painkiller, morphine, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And we measured how many times an hour do they click the button before the distractive entertainment is wheeled onto their bed, while it's there, and then after it goes away. And we were completely wrong. We thought it would be like a channel on the timeline with vertical sides. It's not there. They're feeling the pain. Here it is. They're distracted by the video game or whatever it is. Now it's going away. All the pain comes flooding back. Not true at all. It's actually a gentle slope. Mm-hmm. Where the anticipation of the arrival of the video game, they're already not feeling the pain as much. And even after the trolley goes away, they've still got the sort of glow of the fact that they just scored 18 million points. And that lasts an hour and a half. So we learned a lot. And I think medical science learned a lot by studying what we were doing. It also taught me that what a film producer does is to bring together in one room people who would never meet again. We thought at the beginning, Norman Schwarzkopf and Stephen and I, that what we were doing was colliding Silicon Valley with Hollywood, and the technology would assist the content, and wouldn't that be great? And obviously the medical community is the third corner. But once we started doing it, I realized doctors don't communicate with other types of doctors. I remember being in the UCLA Medical Center, and an oncologist said to me, thank you so much, Stephen and Peter, for, creating this meeting. There are a lot of us in this room who work in the same building, and we've actually never met, even though some of our patients are the same individuals. So I don't know why that is, but we live in silos of knowledge.
Right.
And what producers do is to bust that up and make people communicate for a common goal.
I mean, Peter, it's brilliant. It's the epitome of communication, connectivity, collaboration, and you found that it has health impact. I'm sure you had folks publish these results, and we use them to this day. What are some of the lessons we could learn for even during this pandemic as we've lived in these virtual worlds? How could we translate what you learned through this experience into our lives today?
Well, let me broaden it and say, what have I learned from extensive amounts of philanthropic entrepreneurship or entrepreneurial philanthropy? Number one, I believe the purpose of life is happiness, but I believe it's more complicated than that platitude, because then, well, how do you do that? And I'm here to tell you there are basics like raise children, help them make the best of themselves, have a family of any kind, and pass on lessons, generations, that kind of thing. Secondly, absolutely, it's the case, make something, create something. I'm really proud, not of every film I've ever made, but of some of them. And they'll be here long after I'm gone. And I kind of like that. I still get letters from young men in Tehran, in Iran, who are in hiding because they're gay and their life is at risk. Or Uganda, there was one came from. Mm-hmm. And they say, I've got a bootleg copy of your film about Oscar Wilde. I've watched it 103 times. Thank you so much. It gives me comfort. So there's that. But the third thing I think that is the source of happiness for almost anyone is get outside yourself, help someone else.
Right.
There's always someone worse off than you. take your skill set, get off your derriere, and go and help. Do something using the tools that God or your training have given you, and go and help those less fortunate. And you meet wonderful people. You find yourself happy in ways that sometimes your career can't make you happy, you know? And yeah, also people help you. It's the most amazing thing. I mean, people say, oh, you founded four charities. Hats off to you. Well, thank you very much. I didn't do it. I was just the leader. I was the servant leader of actually either hundreds or in some cases, tens of thousands of volunteers. And we came up with a plan and we put one foot in front of the other and we encouraged people and gave them ownership and gave them credit and kudos. I believe in the Teddy Roosevelt line. It's amazing what you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit.
Absolutely. And true.
It's true on films. It's yep. True in business. It's true in philanthropy.
So two questions. One, what is your favorite film that you've produced? And two, will you share with us some information about First Star?
I will. Let me do number two first, because it's more important than my career. So First Star, I realized at a certain point in Starlight, after running the thing for about 20 years, that people were waiting for me to die so that they could be in charge. And some of them were actually more adept at operational leadership, certainly than I was. I'm a starter-upper. That's why I'm a film producer. You're always starting up a new film. So I thought, well, I announced to great fear and loathing that in a year I would no longer be the president. And I stuck to my date. And so then I looked around and I thought, what on earth is going on in civil rights for children in the United States? How can it be that if a man goes on his front porch with a great big stick and his four-year-old child and his four-year-old dog, if he hits the child and hits the dog equivalently, he'll go to jail in most jurisdictions for animal abuse, but in most jurisdictions of the United States, he has a right to hit his kid. Maybe not to leave bruises, maybe not to break their limbs, but he can hit the child. And I thought, well, that just doesn't, how can that be? And of course, the answer is that American law is based on English common law, which was written, or actually not even written down. It was just the practice of how the law courts worked, starting in an agrarian farming culture, where the purpose of children was that they were chattel. And the reason you wanted boys was because they had bigger muscles to pull a plow and, you know, thresh grain and all the rest of it. So children were property. And the construct of children as chattel or property has remained to the present moment. It seemed to me it was a perfect storm in the area of foster care, because you had almost 500,000 American children in foster care with appalling life outcomes. And if you ask yourself, well, how will it ever get better? You had to really say, well, it won't. It hasn't gotten better in 50 years. Why will it be better in another 50 years? They don't vote. They haven't got any money. They're children. They'll never march. Because of the secrecy laws, you've never read an op-ed by a current foster kid. Why would anything change? They don't employ lobbyists. So I thought, okay, I've just found my new issue. And my thought was, the worst statistic in foster care, on top of the abuse and neglect that drove them into institutional care or care with a stranger family, the worst of it is they almost never go to university. And I thought, surely, if we could get these kids educated and they a bigger proportion than the 9% who go to university of American foster kids, which is a tiny fraction of the 45% of all American 12th graders who go to universities and colleges. I thought, well, if we could get them educated and if they went to university, it would break the generational cycle of abuse and neglect. Furthermore, they wouldn't aspire to sweep the floor in McDonald's. they would be architects and engineers and doctors and lawyers and film producers and whatever. So I thought, well, how do we do that? And I thought, well, all the young people I've ever met in my life are looking for role models. And I thought, so where would there be role models to whom teenage foster kids could look up academically, but also in life skills and in self-esteem and in ambition? And I thought, oh, what about a university? So I took myself off and got, under false pretenses, a meeting with the vice chancellor of UCLA, Gene Block. And I said, I would like to house, educate, and encourage high school age foster kids in the middle of your campus. Please say yes. And 2 hours later, he shook my hand and he said, I think we have to do it. We'll just do it. He said, where will the money come from? And I said, I have no idea, but I bet you we can raise it. And how about this? You keep the green button. If you don't press the button because you're satisfied that we've raised the money, we won't do it. But let's at least give it a shot. So that was 1999. And here we are, all this time later. We have 14 academies at major American universities with high school-aged foster kids. And then we have 3, soon to be 5, in the United Kingdom. That's why I was just over there on this trip. And it, you heard me say 9% of American foster kids go to colleges or universities. Our most recent, and this is during the COVID, our most recent graduates from 12th grade, 87% of them got into colleges and universities. What's extraordinary about that is it's almost exactly double middle-class kids who are not in foster care. So with that conversion rate, all of a sudden, we're like this big solution that I've been going backwards and forwards with the governor of California, Gavin Newsom. He gave us a line item in the California budget. Governor Murphy did the same thing in New Jersey. We're raising the money, we're expanding, and we're sticking to that roughly 87% conversion rate. It was 90% before the COVID. Mm-hmm. We were terrified it would be not nearly as good, but well, 87 is almost 90, right?
It's very, very close. Have you thought about taking this to perhaps Ukraine, as we're dealing with refugees and children who have lost parents and the chaos of the situation of war?
Well, what we are doing, I don't want to tell tales out of school because it hasn't been approved by the board.
Coming attractions, Peter.
Coming attractions, maybe, certainly with my advocacy at the board meeting of First Star in a couple of weeks. And this is true in the UK First Star and in the American First Star. And I run both of them, but separately. I'm the president here and the chairman there. We want to look upon Ukrainian orphans, whether they are or are not in foster care, mm-hmm. As being First Star eligible. Up until now, for all these years, there had to be an open case file with Child Protective Services or whatever they're called in a jurisdiction to get into First Star as a rising 10th grader, interviewed and admitted right. In 9th grade and then start in that summer before 10th grade. We want to make a sort of blessed exception. I hope we want to do that. I have to persuade my colleagues that that's a really timely and important thing to do. Who knows? Check back with me in a couple.
I definitely will. And if anyone can do it, you can. So quickly, what is your favorite film? I know you probably love all of them. They're all your babies, but what's your favorite?
Well, what I'm now doing is I'm determined that my last act of my producing story, I don't know, what have I got left before I hang it up? Another 10 films, 15 films, something like that. They are all going to be double bottom line in the sense that they aspire to be commercial, to have mm-hmm. a nice big audience, but mm-hmm. they also have to partner with 501c3s and aspire to move the needle in the causes, in the deliverables of those nonprofits. So one of the reasons why Filmco Media, which is the new company that I'm just one part of it, which I co-founded with Jonathan Prince, one of the things that said to me, yes, this idea holds water, was that I produced a film just recently called Foster Boy. We had the great disappointment of releasing it straight to VOD because of the COVID, but it's done remarkably well on VOD. But as importantly for me than its commercial success, the subject of the film is foster care run for profit by these enormous New York Stock Exchange companies, some of which do several billion dollars in revenue a year. The whole point of the film is to say foster care should not be run as a profit center. Do it in the best interests of the kids. Government should do it, or at least a nonprofit should do it. So we made the film, and we then created fixfostercare.org, where we have a petition to ask the federal government to stop providing federal financing for foster care entities that are run for profit. Well, because of the film, we've so far got 345,000 signatures on change.org on this handy dandy petition. And we are going to Washington. I'm going to take some of our foster kids from First Star and our other partnering nonprofits. We're going to go to Washington. We need to wait until we can get the attention of the White House and Congress, because at the moment they've got a bit of a war going on in the Ukraine, and they have a different war going on against hopefully the tail end of COVID. But I'm hoping in a small number of months from now, we'll be able to go print out the online petition, put it in cardboard boxes, and go and put it on people's desks and say, with one stroke of the pen, you can stop this. We can have a transition period. All foster care should be run in the best interests of the children who are its clients, not in the best interests of the stockholders of companies, some of whose CEOs are pulling down $500,000-$800,000 a year with money that is intended by the taxpayer to be used to take care of foster kids. There is a better way of doing it, and we should do it the better way.
Well, Peter, you brought up also so many important issues, and we didn't even get to another one, and that's homelessness. And I definitely am going to have you back on our podcast, Always Searching. You've inspired me, as you always do. You also brought me some happiness, hopefully by sharing what you do with the world that brings you happiness as well. And I just thank you for being a humanitarian, a filmmaker, and making sure that everyone's story is heard and that we all have a voice. So thank you so much for joining us on this podcast.
I want to say thank you to you. I'm using you as a proxy for the entire medical profession. So my father is 96, almost 97. He got COVID. We thought it was not looking good. And then he had the new infusion drug. Two guys with an ambulance showed up at the family home in spacesuits, put him in the back on a gurney, took him to a hospital, put him in a bed, gave him an infusion in an IV for 2 hours, took him back home, and starting the following morning, he started to feel better, and he's now COVID-free. So I want to say thank you to you as a proxy for your entire vocation, industry, medicine, and science are amongst our greatest blessings. I have no idea why you get beaten up so much. I have no idea why anti-science is a thing. Seems really Luddite and stupid to me. But I want to say that my dad is still with us because of medical science. And God bless, and keep inventing things that work.
Well, Peter, I think you hit it on the head. Medicine, science, and technology. And what we try to do is question conventional wisdom so that we can all lead good lives, lives filled with health and wellness. And part of that is the science and technology, but it's also that connectivity. It's that connection that you helped to foster among all of us. So we're all doing this together. And I thank you for joining us. And until next time, we're always searching. Thank you so much for listening to Always Searching. Please share it with your community. This podcast was produced by Noah Jones and hosted by me, Dr. Sarah Lynn Mark. Until next time, we're always searching.